From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, should state lawmakers boost donor limits to political campaigns?
This is literally a sop to the 1% of 1% of Michiganders who actually do bump their heads on that limit.
What lessons can Detroit learn from New York's close call with bankruptcy in the 70s?
Do everything possible to make it easy for people to move to Detroit, to make it easy to operate a business in Detroit.
Plus, don't look for regular soda pop if you're at the U of M health system. They have banned sugary drinks.
We have a responsibility to educate and to be the role model for our community in regards to what we think is health policy and healthier choices that we can make.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for joining us on this Monday. When we talk about Detroit's bankruptcy filing, the point seems to be made at all times that this is historic, that Detroit is the largest city in U.S. history to seek bankruptcy protection. But that was almost not the case. In the mid-1970s, New York City was on the brink of its own financial crisis. On today's show, what can Detroit learn from New York's comeback? Are there lessons to be learned? And then, as of today, the University of Michigan Hospitals and Health Centers will no longer sell sugar-sweetened drinks. A not-too-subtle push to get healthy. But is it taking away our choice as a consumer? Is it going too far? Those questions later in the hour. But first, Republicans in Lansing are split over whether people who bankroll so-called issue ads should be allowed to remain anonymous. Now, issue ads are the ones that attack or support politicians or causes, but they don't use what are called magic words, words like vote for or oppose. Unlike campaign ads, the money behind issue ads can be anonymous. But late last week, Michigan Secretary of State Ruth Johnson proposed new rules requiring disclosure of issue ad donations. She said all too often, issue ads are just thinly disguised political ads, and voters ought to know who's paying for them. But many Republicans clearly disagree. In fact, within mere hours of Johnson's proposal, the GOP-led Senate acted quickly to amend a campaign finance bill that would make her new rules illegal. Joining us now is Rich Robinson, executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. Welcome back, Rich.
Thanks, Cindy. Good to be with you.
Also joining us is Jonathan Osting, who's a Capital reporter for MLive.com. Welcome, Jonathan.
Hi, Cindy.
Rich, I'd like to start with you. You are a tireless advocate for more campaign finance disclosure, more transparency. So I'm guessing at first you were pretty pleased with the new rules proposed by Ruth Johnson and then disappointed or maybe surprised by the Senate's action?
Well, I was very pleased with the news release Secretary Johnson put out. I was much disappointed in the letter that she gave to the State Bar of Michigan in response to their request for a declaratory ruling on the disclosure rules. She denied their request, saying that she couldn't divide the baby, she can't make a rule affecting just judicial campaigns and not other campaigns. So rather than saying let's have disclosure in all campaigns, she said let's have none, and punted it off to an administrative rules process. Evidently, that was enough to shake some people, Republican interest groups in particular, and as it manifested itself in the Senate. The committee that was considering a bill to double contribution limits went into an hour-long recess, came back with a slapdash amendment that appeared to be trying to preclude the possibility of an administrative rule proposed by Secretary Johnson, and that very quickly went from committee and passed the full House, the full Senate, rather.
At lightning speed.
At lightning speed, and Jonathan can address that better than I can. He witnessed that.
So, Jonathan, tell us about that. That was, you know, when you think of how often and much debate it takes sometimes to get some kind of an issue across, this sure didn't take long, did it?
No, it didn't, and it's not the first recent example. The Republican legislature also quickly moved to court of claims bills recently, so we saw some recent precedent for this. But like that court of claims bill, this campaign finance bill was only introduced 2 weeks ago. It had one committee hearing canceled abruptly. It finally came back and did another one, made these changes, sent it to the Senate floor the same day, and it's now moving to the House. So certainly, you know, if you blinked, you would have missed it. And maybe that's the point.
Well, Jonathan, yeah, Rob could have been. What are the proponents of nondisclosure saying, meaning basically the Republicans who slam-dunked that bill making Johnson's administrative rules moot? What, they believe this is free speech or what?
Yeah, exactly. They're tying it to free speech. They're saying that increased disclosure of legitimate issue ads could be seen as a form of intimidation for those who bankroll the ads. However, I think the distinction here is the idea of legitimate issue advertising, whereby somebody does promote an idea or tell a legislature to act on a specific topic. Secretary of State Ruth Johnson's administrative rule would have applied just to ads immediately before a primary or general election, which she sees as electioneering ads rather than issue ads. Mm. She actually didn't use the word issue ads at all in her release, you might notice.
What did she use?
Electioneering ads.
Electioneering.
That's exactly. They're also called sham issue advertising by some critics. She didn't go that far, but there's a slight distinction, I suppose.
Let me ask you, Jonathan, what do you think have been the consequences of this kind of throwdown between the Secretary of State and Republican lawmakers? What are you hearing?
I'm not really sure. Secretary Johnson did her press call, of course, before the rules were changed. In fact, while the Senate was changing its bill. So I didn't hear a much of a reaction from her just yet. Arlen Meekhoff, who sponsored the bill and proposed the amendment, refused to say that the change was a direct response to Secretary of State Johnson's proposed rule. However, I think it's pretty evident that, one came directly after the other.
No one could drag that out of him.
Arlen Meekhoff is supposedly positioning himself for a Senate Majority Leader run, and he was very diplomatic in his responses, we could say.
Rich Robinson, does this feel like the status quo in Michigan will be the continuation of this so-called dark money, that there are just way too many interests pushing for nondisclosure?
Well, I don't necessarily think so. For one thing, the Supreme Court has spoken in the past on the words of express advocacy as a standard for differentiating campaign spending from issue advocacy. And they said the idea of express advocacy as a standard is functionally meaningless. So I don't think that that's going to hold water necessarily. I'm not sure this bill as it is will pass the House. The margins are much closer in the House than they were in the Senate, and you'll note that a number of senators who were regarded to be in marginal seats were allowed to take a walk on this vote. And I'm not sure that everyone in the House or all the Republicans are going to want to line up and be identified as enablers of dark money going into an election year. Then there's the whole question of how the governor responds on all of this. He's taken some criticism for running a 501c4 corporation that hasn't disclosed who its donors were, and he seems to be chastened a bit by that, saying that there won't be any more contributions to that particular fund.
And to the nerd fund?
To the nerd fund. So he may have gotten a message here that what the citizens of this state are interested in is transparency and accountability. And I went back and looked at his governor-elect website, where he made a rousing statement on the fact that we need to have transparency and accountability in state government. So he may be reverting back to his values. It may be that his blush with being a politician didn't sit well with him. So I'm not sure how this whole thing's going to come out.
In the meantime, Jonathan Osting, the Senate passed legislation that would increase, in fact, double donor limits to political campaigns. Tell us more about this.
Yeah, sure. Well, you know, since 1977, I believe, we've had limits of, I think it's $500 that an individual can donate to a state house candidate, $1,000 for a Senate candidate, and $3,400 for a statewide election. This would double that for the first time since 77, and it would also include a mechanism whereby the Secretary of State would have to adjust those limits every 4 years to match inflation. Just for, on the political side, Rich mentioned he's not sure it will pass in the House. Well, I think it could face a little more opposition there, and here's why. The bill also includes a deletion of a prohibition on political party caucuses spending in a primary election, and some Tea Party members or potential challengers see that as an attempt by the status quo to protect the establishment candidates. So that could become an issue as well as it comes up for a vote in the House.
Rich, what are your thoughts on this increase? What do you think it'll mean?
Well, it is a statistical truth that 99.99% of Michiganders never have an encounter with a contribution limit to a state candidate. This is literally a sop to the 1% of 1% of Michiganders who actually do bump their heads on that limit. The most we've ever had encounter a limit in an election year was our 2006 gubernatorial, and that year it was 99.85% who were not affected by the contribution limit. So this is something that just isn't needed, and it's a lot like saying, well, the inflation rate based on a market basket with a Learjet, a 10,000-square-foot house, and an 18-carat ruby has shown that we need to increase these limits. I mean, these just don't affect people. And it gives those who have the greatest leverage on office holders even more leverage. That's not what we need.
Rich Robinson speaking. He's the executive director of the Michigan Campaign Finance Network. And he was joined by Jonathan Osting, who's MLive's Capital Reporter. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. If you find yourself craving that perfect icy cold cola or some ginger ale or maybe a frappuccino, should you be able to crack open a can or a bottle of that when you want, even if you know, well, it's not too good for you? The University of Michigan Hospitals and Health Center say maybe not. So beginning today, you will no longer be able to indulge that sweet tooth. They will become one of the first in Michigan to stop selling all sugar-sweetened beverages, with the goal of giving us a none-too-subtle nudge over to healthier drinks. We wanted to take a closer look at this sugar crackdown. Teresa Hanmarkey is a registered dietitian, and she's the internship director for dietetics at U of M. I asked Teresa to give us a scope of what's on the no-no list.
Sugar-sweetened beverages. So those would include your regular soda, your energy drinks, and anything else of a beverage containing sugar per se.
And what is allowed?
And that is a variety of milks, 100% fruit juice, waters, whether they be a little bit of carbonated water or naturally fruit-sweetened waters, and coffee, tea, of course, and lastly, calorie-free soft drinks will remain on the healthy beverage program.
So you can get a Diet Coke, but not a regular one. And when it comes down to it, we all know too much sugar isn't good for you, but how bad is it really? Teresa, why has the U of M adopted this ban on sugary drinks?
Because sugary sweetened beverages are a source of, quote, empty calories. They don't provide any other nutritional things such as vitamins, minerals, or other items we might find in food naturally. So,
but I guess in terms of numbers, if I guzzle down my mm-hmm. large cola, what am I getting in terms of sugar? And
well, at least about 10 teaspoons of sugar in a large Coke. And that's, you know, without even thinking about it.
I did see a quote from the UMHHC chief operating officer saying the health system is committed to providing health options for our community. Is this, though, really providing options? Because isn't it just saying, nope, you don't even get to make the choice. We aren't going to make that available.
Well, staff and faculty and, again, other employees of the health system, no one's going to be there to police whether we decide to bring those beverages mm-hmm. from home.
Okay.
And those can be consumed on site.
All right. So let's say I'm a patient at the hospital. I, for whatever reason,
really, really want a ginger ale.
Mm-hmm.
Will I be able to get one, or do I have to get one with the artificial sweetening?
No, absolutely, Cindy. You'll be able to have that beverage provided for you on your tray. So there is an exception made to our policy, accounting for, again, those instances where patients very, very well might
sure
desire that. And so the policy does allow for that exception.
It does allow. So mm-hmm. patients are not necessarily being told, no, you can't have that.
Correct.
I do have to wonder, when we talked about the, for example, the Diet Coke, mm-hmm. Diet Pops that would be available, mm-hmm. aren't there concerns about that fake sweetening in that as well?
There are questions, yeah. and those questions remain unanswered. So if you look at the literature on artificial sweeteners, you have literature that raises concerns mm-hmm. about artificial sweeteners being linked to other side effects. But yet there's research that also supports that there is no harm in regards to consuming artificial sweeteners, or in whether it be food or in beverage, and having ill effects.
Where there's no question about the sugar and the effects that it's having on our health that way.
Well, certainly the overconsumption of sugar-sweetened beverages and its link to certain diseases.
This certainly kind of echoes the headlines being made in New York City, where Mayor Bloomberg's been trying to impose at least a limit on the size mm-hmm. of the sugary drinks in the Big Apple. He's already been smacked down twice by the courts, but he's still fighting it. He's taking this to New York's highest court, the Court of Appeals. And critics are saying all of that is government overreaching into people's lives. And you must have heard some of that about this, too. Keep your nose out of my business. What I want to drink is what I want to drink.
I did, and just informally asking some of my coworkers
sure.
and whether this is a reach. In other words, is the health system imposing a policy in terms of my own personal choice?
Sure.
But rather, I think also as a health institution, and one that plays a prominent role in our community, we have a responsibility to educate and to be the role model for our community in regards to what we think is health policy and healthier choices that we can make.
Set the example. You know, I saw an interesting big story in the New York Times that showed across the country the sales of pop or soda mm-hmm. are slipping, and bottled water sales are rising. And they're predicting actually that sales of bottled water could top those of these fizzy soft drinks by 2020 and maybe sooner. So is it your sense that Americans are getting the message about
It is. I think so. And we've certainly seen that in our public schools, which has the majority of public schools have retained some vending. But in one sense, they were ahead of the health system, particularly in Ann Arbor, actually, for example, where the contents of the vending machine switched over to only waters and 100% fruit juices a few years ago, as compared to this policy being implemented this year.
Aren't fruit juices a pretty big dose of sugar as well?
It can be, but those are what we consider those naturally found sugars. And so, again, there's a difference between fruit drinks and fruit juices. So what's being provided for sale or, again, on patient trays in the health system will be 100% fruit juices. And in regards to volume, rarely do you see 100% fruit juice in packages of 12-ounce or the big gulp 64-ounce,
True.
But rather the largest serving size we provide will be about one cup.
Which would be
equivalent to about 100 calories and, yeah.
Now, here's a question that I'm sure is being asked around campus. Are there expectations that the sugary drinks ban will go elsewhere on campus beyond the hospitals and health centers?
I'm sure it's being discussed, not in my circles,
yes.
but at this point in time, the policy only holds to the health system campus.
Teresa Hanmarke is a registered dietitian, and she's the internship director for dietetics at the University of Michigan. French women don't get fat. So French writer Mireille Giuliano said in her infamous book. But that did not stop French authorities from introducing a new tax on soda in order to combat obesity and diabetes. While obesity has more than doubled in France over the last 15 years and continues to rise, the country still has far fewer obese people than we see on our streets. David Chuzan prepared this report from Paris as the law was enacted last year.
Before you even open your mouth, you're judged as sloppy, greedy, lazy. They give you no chance.
Beatrix de Lamberti is a member of an association of obese and overweight people which campaigns against discrimination. Over a coffee, she told me that obese people face more discrimination in France than they do elsewhere, partly because there are fewer of them.
Obese people in the United States are just another people. In France, it's very different. You are judged from your looks, and you cannot do what you want. It's difficult to find a job, even a back office job where clients don't see you.
And economists say unemployment resulting from discrimination or illness is one of the costs of obesity. Another is an increase in healthcare expenditure. A new tax on sodas is the latest government initiative aimed at preventing young people from becoming obese. The idea is that if the price is higher, people will consume fewer fattening fizzy drinks. But will it work? Fabrice Etillet is an economist who specialises in health and obesity.
I'm not sure that it will be effective for one reason. People are able to make substitutions between products. If you put a tax on all products in category, then they will substitute low-quality products for high-quality products. They will buy retailer brands instead of Coca-Cola or Pepsi-Cola.
But the head of the National Health and Nutrition Programme, Professor Serge Ersberg, is more optimistic about the effects of the new tax.
We can hope a decrease of 25% in the consumption of soda. We will see in the next future because we will monitor the effects of the tax.
Why is it, do you think, that France isn't suffering from as big an obesity problem as other countries?
In France, we have a special relationship with foods. We have a cultural background very important, and we are very aware about gastronomy, conviviality, the origin of the food. So we don't have a functional vision of the foods.
So leading nutritionists and public health experts in France have used that tradition to devise a characteristically Gallic way to fight the flab, and it's not by dieting. I'm in one of the largest public hospitals in Paris in the nutrition department, and I'm seeing how doctors here treat obese people. They don't put them on a diet, but a group here are being given a cooking lesson. Today they're being taught to cook veal and vegetable stew, the idea being that if they can be encouraged to cook with fresh ingredients, eat a more balanced diet and enjoy their meals, they can be persuaded to give up snacking and improve their health. Professor Arnaud Badvan is the head of department.
The main principle is to say this is not a restrictive diet. Focusing us on diet lead the physician and the patient to forget some major point about eating behavior. This is, eating behavior is a pleasure, it's a social act, and if you miss that, you miss the problem.
So if France has a lesson for other countries, perhaps it's simply a return to a more traditional, family-based approach to meals. But lifestyles are changing, and these days, not everyone can put the French prescription into practice, even in France.
That was the BBC's David Chuzan reporting from Paris. The Michigan Women's Hall of Fame recently announced its latest list of inductees. Among them are six contemporary women and three women from Michigan's past. We're taking a closer look at one of those women from our past, Elizabeth Eaglesfield. She broke ground as one of the first female lawyers in Michigan history, but she did not stop there. Joining us is Jo Ellen Clary of the Greater Grand Rapids Women's History Council. They nominated Elizabeth Eaglesfield. Jo Ellen, tell us what it was about this woman that made you choose to nominate her.
For one thing, she was not just the first woman lawyer in Grand Rapids, one of the first in Michigan. She was one of the first in the entire United States. It was not easy for women in the 19th century to go to law school. Not only did Elizabeth Eaglesfield go to law school 3 years before she graduated from the University of Michigan Law School, she talked her father and a judge in Indiana to set their laws aside to make her the first woman admitted to the bar in Indiana. Then she actually practiced which was a little bit unusual. It was very, very difficult, but she actually was in courtrooms when she could be, despite the fact that most of her clients would have thought she was a liability. She was a force to be reckoned with.
Do we know from any letters or writings, JoEllen, why it was Elizabeth was drawn to the law?
She, I believe, was probably drawn to the law in part because she was part of what we call first-wave feminism today. She was born in 1853, a mere 5 years after the first Women's Rights Convention in Seneca Falls, New York, that very famous gathering. And she was also the youngest of seven daughters of a lumber baron in Indiana, so the family had some means. I'm just guessing when I say that she might have been a slightly indulged youngest daughter. She clearly had ambitions, and she was given an education. She was sent on to Ann Arbor, basically to a prep school, to prepare for an undergraduate degree, which she received in 1876. And she was so proud of these degrees, Cynthia, that she actually had carved into her tombstone in Benton Harbor, 1876, a lit degree from UM, and 1878, a law degree from UM.
She's a cool woman is what she is, isn't she? And she was very involved politically, especially in trying to win the vote for women.
She was involved. That was not her main work. She was supportive. You'll find her in committee listings in the very active Grand Rapids women's suffrage movement. She was not a leader because she was working.
She was busy.
She was very, very busy. In fact, I have found evidence of her listed in a mid-1890s committee for a big suffrage meeting coming to Grand Rapids, and then she kind of disappears. And she was trying to get as much law work as she could. She was actually a single mother while she was doing all of this. So she, when the son came of age, took to the lakes and became a lake lawyer. The son was 20 in 1900 and wanted to go on to the lakes, so they did.
Did I read, am I right, she actually was a certified sea captain?
She has captain's papers. That's the language I'm willing to use.
Okay, fair enough.
I have not seen that she was the first woman to have them, though she very well may have been. She would not have been the primary captain in their business. She and her son, between the early 1900s and 1935, in the midst of the Depression, owned or had built four or five fruit boats, which they ran across the lake from Benton Harbor eventually, which was a major fruit market, into Wisconsin and Illinois, including Chicago. While I dare say she did captain occasionally, her son would have been primarily running that side of the business.
Still, that's quite a difference from standing before a judge in a courtroom. And then something else we've certainly seen a lot of during the recent recession is flipping houses. You buy that low-priced house, you fix it up, you sell it for a profit. This is a forward-thinking lady, right? She was doing a lot of that.
She did what she could and what she had to. We'll find her in legal records both suing and being sued. As a woman lawyer, she was often appointed a caretaker or guardian of recently widowed women who couldn't represent themselves or their children. And sometimes there was real estate involved that she might have gotten involved in managing. She also then stepped into buying what would probably today be at bank sales, but she and the county sheriff were at one point sued for their management of for probably flipping a house that would have been sold at a sheriff's sale.
Okay.
So she was making money however she could.
What do you like most about Elizabeth?
Oh, her energy. She was just a bulldog. She forged ahead. She opened all kinds of paths for women. Elizabeth Eaglesfield advertised in a Grand Rapids paper in 1878 when she was 25 years old. She then was gone for a few years, but she came back in 1886 and was here steadily for 30-some years. She was a great self-promoter. They say our strengths are related to our weaknesses, and I dare say in her case that probably was also true. She was called the Lady Lawyer from Grand Rapids, and she dared take on anybody.
Elizabeth Eaglesfield died in Benton Harbor in 1940, and she is now one of the newest inductees in the Michigan Women's Hall of Fame. JoEllen Clary of the Greater Grand Rapids Women's History Council, which nominated Elizabeth. It has been a lot of fun talking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. In virtually every single discussion and report about Detroit's bankruptcy filing, the point is made that this is historic, that Detroit is the largest city in U.S. history to seek bankruptcy protection. But that was nearly not the case. New York City was a hair's breadth away from earning that unenviable distinction in 1975. We wondered what comparisons could be drawn between Detroit's crisis today and New York's in the 70s, and if there are lessons Detroit could learn from New York's recovery. My next guest may have some insights for us. He has taught at Yale for 46 years. He was part of five New York City governments, and he's a noted urban planner, educator, and author. Alex Garvin, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you so much.
Alex, how close was New York City to going broke in 1975?
It was a matter of days and hours. You may remember there was a famous headline in the New York Daily News, Ford to New York dropped dead.
Yes.
We knew that there was not going to be any money from Washington. What had happened is that we had been spending money we didn't have. That was one of the problems. We were putting our annual spending into the capital budget. That is something that nobody should do. We also were running a deficit, and we were facing the problem of increasing rates of interest. This was the aftermath of the Vietnam War, and there was inflation. And we had bonds that we had put out for more than $1 billion, and they were to finance housing mortgages for working people. And when the buildings were ready to go into permanent financing, nobody wanted to increase the rents.
Mm.
But the interest rates kept going up, and eventually the bank said, sorry, we're not going to lend you any more money. And to give you a sense of how different the response was in New York from everything you've been hearing, when I became the Deputy Housing Commissioner of the City of New York in 1974, I had a staff of 300 people. And when I moved on to be the Director of Comprehensive Planning in 1978, I had 75.
Wow.
We downloaded 20% of the city's working personnel. And nobody is talking about the kinds of things that cities are required to do if they're going to be run intelligently. And I don't see anybody serious in Washington, and I have yet to see what's going to come out of your bankruptcy court.
As you've watched these headlines unfold and the story unfold in Detroit, what in the situation here rings a bell and makes you see connections?
We also had extremely strong unions, and they had negotiated contracts with benefits and costs that the city could not afford.
And which sounds familiar to us here.
Yes, and we had actually to change some of the terms of those deals, and for a period of time, we also had to stop spending money on any kind of capital investment. We had, by the time the money began to flow back, we had potholes in streets, we had dead trees on the streets, we had patches in almost all of the schools, and what we had to do then is to reinvest in our capital plant and equipment, because for a period of 5 or so years, we had been disinvesting, and I know you have the same thing.
You know, as much as we in Michigan suffered from the Great Recession of 2008, that recession of 73 was a very, very tough time for our country and for New York.
It wasn't the recession that caused this. It was maladministration in New York. We had to find $3 billion. Now, of course, today we have a $70 billion budget. I don't remember what the size was back then, but it was a fraction of it. I assure you that finding $3 billion is a very difficult thing, even in a city that had as large a budget as we did. And, of course, you remember that at that time not only did we have a downturn, but President Nixon terminated all the housing programs that were running. We actually had thousands of potential housing sites that we had acquired, relocated people from their homes, torn down the buildings, and we were ready to build up. This was the time that you did, the finest urban renewal project, probably one of the two or three in the United States, and that's Lafayette Park.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we had sites like that all over New York and no money to build them because Nixon stopped the money.
We're speaking with Alex Garvin, urban planner, educator, and author. He has taught at Yale for 46 years, and he was part of five New York City governments. As we look at New York's brush with bankruptcy in 1975 and what lessons we might learn here in Detroit in terms of what happened in New York. And Alex, what was it that saved New York from bankruptcy?
I think probably the governor. Governor Hugh Carey was determined that New York City would not go bankrupt. He came from Brooklyn, and he worked very hard, and we got an agency set up. I don't remember its name, but the agency's role was to supervise the finances of the city of New York until everything had been put back in order. And the fact that there was an agency that could require the city government to do things allowed the leadership of the city to make those tough choices. And over time, we paid back and got the money that we had borrowed. We sold some of our mortgages at a discount, of course. We bought textbooks. We put it in the city's capital budget to be amortized over 30 or 40 years. We stopped doing that. There were accounting practices that we had to adopt. And I believe that the mayor, Abraham Beam, and deputy mayor, John Zuccotti, worked very hard to fulfill the obligations. But that board that supervised the finances made sure that the incoming Koch administration in 1978 didn't do things as they had been done previously. And, of course, we shed a large portion of the city workforce.
Alex, would it be fair to draw an analogy between that board set up by Governor Carey to what's happened here in Detroit with Governor Snyder appointing Kevin Orr as emergency manager with very
no.
wide-ranging powers, or no?
No, because he is a bankruptcy lawyer, as I understand
mm-hmm.
it. And the man who was appointed by Carey was an investment banker. And there was a whole committee of people who knew about finance. And we had to borrow money constantly to cover our capital budget. Otherwise, we couldn't repair the schools or the potholes or anything else. And it's a different situation. Also, they had, I think, less powers than your bankruptcy attorney does.
Yes, he does have the powers in that respect. I was getting the sense, as you described that board, that it was able to kind of push the city in directions it might not have gone, but...
Exactly.
And so emergency manager is doing that, but then some, because he has that absolute power.
But as I understand it, you also had retirement benefits, pensions, and things that were negotiated that are solemn obligations of the city. We didn't yet have them. We're beginning to have them now, I might add. And there's always a chance. I know that New York City is going to face some very tough decisions in the coming year or two because the entire city workforce, nearly 300,000 people, all are working without a contract. The unions and Mayor Bloomberg were unable to reach an agreement, and the union leadership has announced that not only do they need to have their contracts negotiated and signed, with increases, of course, but they expect back pay at those increased levels. And we already are facing a $2 billion deficit in the next fiscal year. So this is an ongoing problem in many cities, and there are times when the cities are well-run financially.
Mm-hmm.
There are times when the economy is doing well, which makes it easy to do things. What often happens is during those good times, the spending grows instead of reducing the debt at that point.
Alex, how was New York City different, particularly in terms of its business climate, after the recovery from this fiscal crisis? Was there a new power base and a new feel and look to the city?
No. What we had as an advantage is something you do not have, and that is we were coming out of a decline in population. The Immigration Act of 1965 changed New York more than any single thing. So if you asked me who was responsible for the turnaround, I would tell you Lyndon Johnson, because it was during his time that we reopened immigration to the United States, which was closed down in the 20s. And we today have more than 40% of our population having been born in another country. And these people come here, and they're willing to work hard and invest. They start companies. We began to see trading companies that didn't exist, whole neighborhoods which were being abandoned by people who moved to the suburbs were suddenly occupied by a population that thought that this was so much better than what they had at home, whether they came from Russia or China or Latin America. And they came from all those places, and they made a huge difference. The other thing is we are still the financial center of the world. And even though we have competition from London and Singapore and Tokyo and Shanghai, that gives us an edge up. Finding money in New York is something that people do from all over the world. That helped as well.
It certainly seems, as you talk about the impact of immigration, Alex, that definitely echoes conversations that are being held here in Michigan. And even our governor has said, let's get this immigration reform and get these immigrants in here, because they will do exactly what you described, move into the neighborhoods and make it vibrant and set up businesses. So it seems like immigration reform from Washington is a key element in keeping these big cities like Detroit, getting them back to recovery.
I certainly think so. If I had one observation about what is an anti-urban policy, it is the failure of the United States government to pass immigration reform, despite the fact that we now have had two presidents in a row, George Bush and Barack Obama, saying that we ought to do it.
Alex Garvin, as you watch Detroit's bankruptcy story unfold, and based on your experience right there in the front lines of New York's brush with bankruptcy, what advice would you give to Mayor-elect Mike Duggan and his appointees?
Do everything possible to make it easy for people to move to Detroit. Do everything possible to make it easy to operate a business in Detroit. Do everything possible to avoid all of the costs of doing business in Detroit. And that includes private sector actions as well. If that can happen, you have a huge asset. You have a land bank of extraordinary value and location right outside downtown. A number of not just empty lots, but empty buildings that could be filled up. All you need is to collect the taxes from those places, and suddenly you're going to have a revenue stream. I would add, I know every city, ours included in New York, has regulations that make it onerous to run a business. All kinds of papers that have to be filed, fees that have to be paid, regulations you have to obey. If you could remove them, suddenly when somebody had a choice of either moving to one of the suburbs of Detroit or moving to Detroit where the land is cheap and can be almost given away for nothing, you'd find that you'd have these businesses and they would employ people, and that would begin the change in the economic situation in the city.
And what about advice to state lawmakers? Because we have such a history of Detroit and the rest of Michigan, and there's a need to build a greater sense of understanding that we're all one state.
What's lurking underneath that question is something that the United States has yet to deal with everywhere, and that's the problem of race. You have a predominantly white suburban ring and a predominantly non-white Detroit. That has been the product of everything since the Second World War. That's the first thing to deal with, and that's very difficult because you have to be honest about these things. The second thing I would say is we learned that you have to enforce the law. If you don't enforce the law, you're making the neighborhoods, the people who are defenseless, the ones that they live in, dangerous for them. And they're the ones who get hurt. And simple things like fixing broken windows and making sure that there aren't fires and making sure that you don't have potholes and that the regular city government works is vital, because that's what begins to provide people a sense of security that things will be fixed when they're broken. And then they want to live there, and then they begin to do things. And also, everybody has to assume responsibility. You know, I'll give you my favorite example. New York and Detroit have filthy streets, right?
Okay.
Lots of litter, right?
Yes.
That's not because we have inadequate amounts of people working in the Department of Sanitation. That's because people are throwing things on the sidewalk and on the street. If we had a society that wasn't dropping litter everywhere, whether it's cigarette butts or chewing gum or just plain garbage, suddenly you wouldn't have to spend money on the Department of Sanitation. And start thinking about the sorts of things like that that people can do, which would make a real difference.
That costs not one penny. Alex, from your perspective and what you, from having gone through this experience in New York, do you believe Detroit can recover?
Absolutely. Detroit is one of the great cities of the United States. You have a remarkable asset. Even in this downturn, I have been watching the waterfront of the Detroit River slowly be turned into a linear park. This is a city going bankrupt, and you're creating that. I also think that Lafayette Park is a jewel in the United States, alive and well, integrated, fully occupied, in good condition, in the middle of devastation. You can learn from what happened there. And you also have to stop making foolish decisions like Renaissance Center, which did not save Detroit, but in fact sucked up all the business from the regular streets and the regular buildings and moved them into this complex. Very beautiful, very exciting, but left vacancies in office buildings downtown.
Yeah, yeah. Alex Garvin, it was a real pleasure talking with you.
Mine as well.
Alex Garvin has taught at Yale for 46 years. He was part of five New York City governments, and he's a noted urban planner, educator, and author of The Planning Game, Lessons from Great Cities, and The American City, What Works, What Doesn't. It's always interesting to get an outsider's view of our city and our state, and we'd like to hear what you thought of Alex Garvin's comments. You can find us on Facebook, search for Stateside with Cynthia Canty. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and as always, you can find us at MichiganRadio.org. Just click on the link that says Stateside. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Riley Linebaugh, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Claire Tennisketter, and John K. Wilson. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.